content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the November 15th, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Hello, Goodbye by Yiyun Lee. Nina held between her hands baby-shaped air, her left hand supporting an unseen head, heavy for the supple neck, her right hand padding. She had read somewhere that an infant found it calming when the mother's padding matched her heartbeat. Guitar? Ethan guessed. Nina shook her head. She changed her position so the baby would be upright. She had recently begun to pay attention to mothers with infants. Burping? Katie said. Nursing? Nina blinked twice and switched back to rocking the air. Baby? Katie said. Infant? The second word might be easier. Nina waddled around the ottoman. Duck? Ethan said. Duckling? Baby duckling? Katie said. Baby duckling? That's what I would call redundancy, Ethan said. His voice had a grating quality like sandpaper, but Katie didn't seem to notice. Perhaps even the coarsest sandpaper would leave no damage on a night smoothed by drinks and youthful optimism, Nina thought. Ugly duckling? Katie tried again. Nina went back to pampering the air, and then waddling, pampering and waddling. Oh, I know, Katie shouted. Mother Goose? Yes, Nina said, making way for the next person. Hickory dickory dock, the mouse went up the clock, she hummed as she took a seat. Nina was 27, not helplessly young, yet far from being trapped in a mildewed marriage, as she tended to believe many middle-aged women were. Things were going well for her and her friends that year. The Y2K bug had not materialized. The Twin Towers still stood. Everyone had a few ideas for a startup. Katie and Nina worked in a marketing in Silicon Valley, and both were confident that before long they would found the next hot company. They were planning to travel to Prague the following summer. They were impressionable and therefore predictable, though neither realized it then. They found joy in what they were told contained joy. Birkenstocks, artistically designed CD racks, a new platform for bloggers called Live Journal, Yo-Yo Ma's solos in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Nina and Katie had met as roommates in their freshman year at Berkeley. Neither was a California native, and they had spent their college years together, becoming Californians. There had never been a doubt that after graduation they would stay in California. Returning to where they had come from was not an option. Nina was the daughter of Chinese immigrants who owned a grocery store, East-West Market, in a college town in Kansas. Her father drove a refrigerated truck to Chicago once a week to pick up stock. Her mother tended the shop, and her paternal grandmother cooked homemade food, which was sold inexpensively and served in their minimally remodeled garage to graduate students and visiting scholars from China. Katie had grown up in a small town in Indiana. Her father was a locksmith, and her mother worked in the cafeteria at the high school. A genetic disease that affected only boys ran in her family. Katie, who had no brothers, felt for her male cousins and their parents. She thought her family, with three daughters, was luckier. They were both girls with some history, but it was history taken on credit from their families. They scarcely had a past. Mistaking a backpacking trip in Wales to celebrate their 25th birthdays together for their past, and, before that, the ordinary heartaches they'd collected in high school and college. They thought about their future as a game of connect the dots, from ideas to IPOs. They were lucky. That much they knew. They had both had friends in their hometowns whose futures, seen through their California prism, looked dim, even bleak. They were lucky. But they did not know that theirs was beginner's luck. 20 years had passed since that game of charades. Katie had not married Ethan, who had not reciprocated her love. Nor had she married any of the slew of men after him, all seemingly suitable, yet each exhibiting flaws that were intolerable to Katie. Sometimes Nina thought about the Matthews and the Jakes and the Dustins whom Katie had dated and wondered where they were in their lives. Harmless bores, Katie called them. Nina's husband, Daniel, a pediatric dentist, fell into the same category, though Katie never pointed that out. She did not have to. Raymond, the man Katie did marry, was 28 years older than she and had sold 3 companies and taken up a semi-retired life by the time they were married. Raymond was not a harmless bore. Rather, he was a bully and a bore, though Nina had voiced this thought only to herself. One afternoon, Nina sat on her porch with Katie, who had arrived with 4 marigolds and several rosemary sprigs from her garden, which garnished the gin and tonics they were now drinking. Raymond was on the road again, this time in a new extra-deluxe RV. He dreaded flying. Nina had never asked what was behind that, but she wished he were plagued by many more fears. At the beginning of the marriage, Katie had traveled with Raymond in his RV. In recent years, she had been joining Nina and her family on their summer holiday instead. "The way he goes around as though COVID were fiction? I won't be surprised if he gets it," Katie said. "Well, but you could get it from him," Nina said. What she really wanted to say was, "Well, he's not that young, is he?" "I'm moving out," Katie said. "He's away for more than 2 weeks. Now's the perfect time." Oh, the resolution was not a new one, and Nina did not expect much to come of it. "I'm serious. I hired that forensic accountant I told you about." Until the week before, Nina had not known what a forensic accountant's job entailed or that such an expert might be needed to dissolve a marriage. Katie had stopped working in marketing after the wedding and had started a boutique spice shop with 2 other women who, like Katie, needed something to do and a reason to get out of the house. For years, Katie had been talking about divorcing Raymond. Crying wolf, but now the real wolf was about to show up in the form of a forensic accountant. "What do you think?" Katie asked. "Why now? Don't you want to wait until the pandemic is over?" Nina said. It was a refrain for her at the moment. Anything that required her attention, anything that demanded a decision, she moved to an indeterminate future time when she would no longer have an irrefutable excuse. "How long will the pandemic go on?" "Who knows?" "Then I don't want to wait," Katie said. "Nothing happens now. I need to get something done." Was boredom a good reason to divorce Raymond? No reason would be bad, Nina thought. "All right, what can we do to help?" she said. "Do you need a place to stay?" Their house was a quarter the size of Katie and Raymond's house up in the hills, but they could make room for Katie. The girls wouldn't mind, and Daniel had foreseen this inevitability for years. Katie said that she would think through everything that weekend. They drank more and talked about their canceled trip to Japan. They had been planning to fly to Tokyo after the Olympics. They had gone to Rio in 2016 and London in 2012. Going to a party after the revels were over appealed to both of them. For Nina, it was a financial consideration. For Katie, something akin to a good joke. "Remember the innkeeper in Dubrovnik? The guy who complained about his wife?" Katie said, recalling another vacation they'd shared right after Nina got engaged. Katie had said that they needed a holiday to celebrate their last days of freedom. "Sort of," Nina said. "Tell me again." Nina liked to be told stories, and Katie was good at telling stories. In college, when they watched a movie together, Nina would have forgotten nearly everything about it within days. But Katie could recount the movie, sometimes shot by shot, so that Nina could see it in her mind's eye once more. Memories. The shared ones, and the ones that Katie saved up from her life to amuse Nina, were related as if they were scenes from movies. Even the most mediocre stories became entertaining in Katie's telling. The man in Dubrovnik was one of those harmless bores. After taking down their passport information, he had seated himself on the patio, speaking to Nina and Katie in fairly fluent English. Other than the bench and a patch of space around it, the patio was covered by flower pots. The man complained about his wife, whose biggest sin he said, was her addiction to buying potted plants.
But they make the patio look nice, Katie said.
3 pots are enough for looking nice. She has 36 here, the man said. He pointed to the courtyard. There are more down there, and she's still buying. They cost money. The water costs money. The exchange had gone on for a while. Katie talking, Nina listening, the husband complaining, and the wife, who spoke no English, smiling at them while carrying a giant watering can up and down the steps.
You should buy her a garden hose, Katie said to the man.
Why should I? The man said. I don't want to make it easy for her.
On Nina's porch, Katie reproduced their exchange with the innkeeper, altering her voice and accent and acting out his grudge.
Later that night in Dubrovnik, Katie and Nina got lost heading back from a club, and an English couple had tried to help, but none of them could identify where they were on the map, all having drunk a bit too much and having difficulty distinguishing one statue from another. In the end, it was Nina who decided to follow a trickle of water that the night breeze had not yet dried.
Remember, you said you'd noticed the water running down from the patio into the street when we left the apartment, Katie said.
Why, have you forgotten that?
Why is it that some people's memory is not as good as others? Have you ever wondered?
There was a difference between forgetting and not remembering. Nina was not as forgetful as Katie thought. It was just that she did not indulge herself by bringing the past into focus. Nina did not believe in the benefit of seeing the past or the future with too much clarity. One could lead to undue nostalgia, the other to unwarranted alarm. The present was another matter. She wanted to be as clear-eyed as possible about the present. But she said none of this to Katie. She liked to imagine Katie revisiting their fairy tale-like youth, when the water from 36 drenched pots had led them back to safety in a foreign city.
Who knew we could do this? Nina said, taking the marigold out of her glass and swirling it.
Do what? Katie asked.
What is this?
Being married, Nina said, and being middle-aged.
Well, we've done more than that, haven't we? You have your children, and I'll get my divorce.
Well, children are optional, Nina said. Of course she loved her daughters, but being stuck in the bungalow since the beginning of March had made the girls at once older and younger. They sounded more like the teenagers they would become in a year or two, and they had also rediscovered their talent for throwing tantrums. Raymond had 2 childless marriages before Katie. He had never wanted children. Katie had offered this up as an argument in support of his candidacy as a husband. A marriage has to start with some consensus, Katie said, as though that could explain away the impulsiveness of her decision. She had seen several aunts devastated by their son's inherited illness. She herself did not want any heartache from her marriage. Nina preferred to think that Katie had been spared that. At dinner that evening, Nina told her family that Katie might need to move in for a short time. The girls liked Katie, as she did not commit the cardinal sin common among adults, interfering where she had no right to. Daniel, an experienced calmer of squirming and screaming children in his dentist chair, was good at keeping his opinion to himself. Even so, he had drawn the line at Raymond, whom he despised. Daniel was a solid and a good man. Nina's 2 sisters adored him, a family man with an even temper. Her mother approved of Daniel's profession, but not his receding hairline. Her father, making his best effort to tone down his criticism, remarked only that he himself could not see the merit in a man who would not give out as much as a silent fart, even if you beat him with a stick.
Will Katie take a COVID test before she moves in?
Ella, the cautious 12-year-old, asked. Nina had once fretted about Ella's rigidness, but her habit of frequent hand-washing had turned out to be a desirable thing under these new circumstances. Nina said that for sure Katie would get tested. Paige, who was 11, asked if her best friend Cameron could move in if she, too, took a COVID test. Nina replied that Cameron's parents might not see that as a good idea. If her parents are fine with the idea, Paige pressed, can we have her too?
You see her on Zoom every day, Nina said.
But we haven't seen each other in person for 4 months, Paige said. If Katie can come for a drink, why can't Cameron come over for a visit?
Before Nina could form an answer, Ella said, grown-ups think they're more trustworthy, but there's no evidence for that.
It's so not fair, Paige said.
Nina would be fine with Paige and Cameron doing a few outdoor activities, but Cameron's grandparents lived nearby, and her parents, having made a family pod, weren't socializing with anyone else. Nina wished Daniel would say something about the good they were doing for the future by tolerating some inconvenience now. Nina could not bring herself to say those reasonable words. Even the thought made her feel tired. She wished she could tell Paige to shut up and finish her meal. But there was a reason she never talked to her children like that. She and her sisters had grown up with similarly strong and stronger words from their parents.
Really, Mommy, don't you think grown-ups are stupid enough to mess up the world for us?
There's no guarantee we'll be better when we grow up, Ella said. Ella's premature defeatism often alarmed Nina. Shouldn't a child have a childlike sense of justice and childlike optimism? The few times that Nina had brought up the worry with Daniel, he'd rightly pointed out that Nina also wished Paige could be more rational, like Ella.
Who wants ice cream? Nina said.
Diversion was a parental tactic she had learned from Daniel.
Katie and I made some this afternoon.
What flavor? Daniel asked.
Mango, Nina said. Katie brought mangoes.
Cameron can bring mangoes too, just so you know, Paige said.
Nina scooped 4 perfect balls of ice cream into 4 bowls. Only then did she allow herself to speak.
Paige, Cameron's mom does not feel comfortable with the idea of a playdate.
More of a reason for us to rescue her, Paige said.
Rescue her from what? Nina asked.
Some children feel homeless even when they have a home, Ella explained with a patient equanimity, the way she would point out to Paige that the snail she had drawn with was a rare species, as most snails had shells that swirled in the opposite direction.
Daniel looked at Ella and then Paige.
Is that how you feel? He said.
No, Ella said, but I can't speak for Cameron.
I can, Paige said.
Do you think she'd be happier if she moved in with us? Daniel asked.
Of course, Paige said. Do you know how hard it is to be the only child? It's always 2-1, her parents outvoting her and then saying it's democracy.
Well, have you thought of moving in with Cameron? Ella said, so you could get a vote there?
Nina wished that Ella had not put that idea into Paige's head, but fortunately a chunk of mango in Paige's bowl distracted her.
The children believed that finding a piece of mango or strawberry in their ice cream brought special luck, which struck Nina as illogical. She could easily offer them a bowl of mango or strawberries without generating such enthusiasm. At the end of August, Katie moved into Ella and Paige's playroom, only for a couple of weeks, until she found a place, Katie said. She had hired a real estate agent who dressed in PPE that looked like a spacesuit, visited the potential rentals with her iPad, and showed Katie the walkthrough from different angles. The good thing about Katie looking for an apartment or a house virtually was that Nina could be there to offer a second opinion. She would not have been able to check out all the places with Katie in normal times. Having an additional person interrupted the monotony of housebound family life. Paige's remarks were now often addressed to Katie, hoping for agreement or approval, which Katie was always ready to offer.
You wouldn't have known what a doomsday looked like when you were our age, right?
Paige said to Katie one morning when they were all dumbfounded by the unfamiliarly eerie orange color of the sky as smoke from a wildfire covered the Bay Area.
No, I never saw a real doomsday, Katie replied. I only worried about things that would never happen.
Like what?
Like a nuclear war. I worried that I would still be a virgin when the world ended, Katie said.
Why is your mom frowning at us?
Because she's trying to look like a parent, Paige said, and she's a Puritan.
Where did you learn that word? Nina said. You don't know what a Puritan is.
She learned it from me, Ella said. She was reading a brick-thick book at the far end of the living room. A Puritan, a.k.a. a hypocrite, is a condition, like a virus. Parents catch it easily.
Nina wanted to say that a person cannot be a condition, but who was she to teach Ella anything?
One afternoon, while Katie was showing Nina a bed she was thinking of ordering, Ella stood behind them, knocking her teeth against the edge of a glass of lemonade as though it were the glass she meant to consume. It was a habit that Nina found distracting, though she had never said anything.
I feel bad for the bedmaker's lack of imagination, Ella said after finally taking a sip of the lemonade. Queen bed, king bed, California king. Why is there never a dictator-sized bed?
Don't suggest that to Trump, Katie said.
Some entrepreneur could make a fortune naming a bed after him, Ella said.
Like Raymond, Katie said. He would do that in an instant.
Raymond's name was not forbidden in the house, but Nina had never told the girls anything concrete about the man. She herself preferred not to dwell on the many dramas that Katie had told her about over the years. Once, at a restaurant, Katie had thrown her wine in Raymond's face, and he, in turn, had thrown his wine in her face, and, when a waiter approached, Raymond had pushed a $100 bill into his hand and told him to shut his mouth and bring an extra set of napkins. Once, after a quarrel, Raymond had left Katie in a parking lot in Reno and driven on to Idaho by himself, and Katie, instead of renting a car, had taken a $2,000 cab ride back home because, she said, why not? It's his money, in any case. After a wedding in San Diego, Raymond had cornered Katie in their hotel room, insisting that she remove her underwear because he wanted to take a sniff. He had seen her flirt with a guest, he said, and then had noticed they were both absent from the party for some time. Katie had narrated these episodes to Nina as though they were merely scenes from movies about bad marriages, which could be forgotten afterward.
He sounds like an awful person, Ella said.
He is an awful person, Katie said.
Why did you marry him? Ella asked.
Why indeed, Nina thought. Katie glanced at her.
Because I wasn't as smart as you are, and I didn't have parents as smart as yours to tell me a thing or two.
Mostly we're smart, Paige said, appearing just in time to correct Katie. No offense, but grown-ups are mostly pretty stupid.
Well, that's why I married an awful man, Katie said.
Nina wondered why neither she nor Daniel was good at having conversations with their children. They sounded like dull parents, and they sounded as though they didn't have much confidence in their imposter selves, but nevertheless hoped for some reward for their effort.
When she voiced this worry, Katie said, "But you love them, don't you?"
"Yes." "Well, that's enough."
"Is it, though?" Nina thought, watching Katie measure their drinks. The air outside was heavy with smoke, and they had to forego the porch.
Did your parents ever worry about their conversational skills with you guys?
Mine didn't. And we've turned out fine, Katie said. Besides, what can parents do for children?
Things go well for a child or things don't go well. We know it's really just luck.
Someone working with a forensic accountant had to be pragmatic and unsentimental. Still, Nina frowned at the drink passed to her.
What? You think I'm too indifferent? Katie asked.
No, not that, Nina said. Did I tell you about Ella's friend who shoplifted at Sephora?
When? What happened? You never tell me stories, Katie said.
But it was not a mere story, Nina thought, looking at Katie with her usual inarticulate doubt. Early in the year, a girl in Ella's class had been posting pictures on Snapchat of lip glosses she had sneaked out of Sephora. When it happened a third time, Ella told Nina, who wondered if she should talk to the girl's parents or if she should check in with any of the other parents in the class, but Ella sternly warned her not to.
Surely she'd be mortified if her mother was a snitch, Katie said.
Well, that's how Paige would feel, Nina said. Ella, she explained, had a different attitude. She thought her friend was stupid to post the pictures. Someone was bound to take a screenshot. In fact, Ella said she had done just that all three times, though she refused to show the pictures to Nina. What if the girl kept doing it and then was caught one day? Nina asked Ella. Did she not think that the parents should know so that they could do something to help her? But that was exactly the reason the parents shouldn't be told, Ella said. Grown-ups would be of no help. They would only kick up a big fuss about the wrong thing and make life difficult for the girl and for her friends who had seen the pictures without reporting the crime. She said, and I quote, "Things will go right for us if we're lucky. Things will go wrong if we're not lucky. There is nothing you parents can do." "Didn't I just say the same thing?" Katie asked. "Ella," Nina said, "is 12. If a 12-year-old hasn't thought through these things, how much hope do you have for her? You should be happy for Ella." How could I be, Nina thought. The world holds a perpetual scolding power over all parents. No, not all parents, but those who want to be good and do the right thing for their children. Even so, she could muddle through being Paige's mother. But being Ella's mother made her feel that she was no more than a frog trapped in a pot of water along with Ella. If they were unlucky, if the water were brought to a slow boil, what could Nina do but endure the fate with her daughter? A long-forgotten moment from Ella's infancy came to Nina. Ella was 7 months old and had just begun to crawl. One day, Nina noticed that the baby's knees, once smooth and unblemished, had started to show a few creases. No parenting handbook or blog had prepared Nina for that, wrinkles and creases on a baby's kneecaps, a price paid for mobility. Nina uncharacteristically wept. Another person, Daniel or Katie, or one day Ella herself as an adult, would explain Nina's tears as a result of exhaustion and postpartum hormone changes. They would not be wrong, and yet Nina, caressing her baby's knees, had envisioned all the things she would not be able to shield her child from, starting with the carpet. What blind courage had led her into motherhood? And yet, she thought now, those knees, less perfectly smooth than they had been the day before, what did that matter in the larger scheme of things? Her mother, toiling away amid the shelves at East West Market, had hardly noticed the scrapes and bruises that Nina and her sisters had incurred as they grew up. Her maternal grandparents, boat people on the Yangtze River, had begun one day with 8 children on the boat, and at the end of the day counted 7. "So did you say anything to the girl's parents?" Katie asked. "No." "Well, what happened after?" "Nothing, as far as I know," Nina said. "The pandemic started. The girl wouldn't have had an easy opportunity to do it again." "Why? Do you think I should have said something?" "Would you prefer to be told about it if you were the girl's mother?" "Yes." "Well, don't be so certain," Katie said. "Did I ever tell you the story about my cousin Jock? The one who died in his sophomore year?" "Yes, but I only told you about his death," Katie said. How strange, Nina thought, that after a young life ends, people think and talk about the death more than the life. It is easier that way. Tragedies and catastrophes always have an ending. Perhaps that was why Katie could tell many good stories about the violent and dire moments in her marriage. Dramas lent a sheen of bravado to a bad choice. Harder to communicate, which was perhaps the reason Katie never did, was the enduring unhappiness. Boring, Katie would call the stretches of time between crises, physical closeness fused by a passion that was not love, everyday interaction without the kindness of everydayness, a truce that promises no peace. Katie would insist there was nothing to say about those times, but the truth was that neither she nor Nina had words for what could not be fitted into the mold of a story. Are good choices and bad choices all that different? The consequences of those choices are where life is, and there Nina and Katie were similarly muddled. "There was this crazy teacher, Mrs. Gill, in 5th grade, Katie said. Every year she picked out one boy, a sort of psychological pincushion for her, and physical too. Don't ask me why no adult interfered. They knew about it, but they would tell themselves two things. One, Mrs. Gill had been teaching for decades and must be respected. And two, it affects only one boy per year. So the rest of the class will still benefit from having a good teacher. Well, what did she do to the boys? Nothing criminal. She gave them nasty nicknames. She pinched them on their upper arms when she felt like it. In winter, she hid their coats and told them they had to go out to the playground during recess without the coats. One boy per year. No one could do anything to help you if you happened to be that boy. And the funny thing is, she knew to choose the boys who could do nothing to help themselves. Nina thought of protesting. How could people let this go on? Yet she knew not to. Terrible things happen all the time, to the deserving and the undeserving. People are never short of excuses for inaction. And when we were in the fifth grade, my cousin Jock was the chosen boy. Well, what about the parents of those boys? What about your aunt and uncle? Well, Jock's father had already left, so there was only my aunt. Did you think Jock should have told her about it? He didn't. None of Mrs. Gill's boys was a tattletale. There was an unfamiliar rigidity in Katie's face. Nina felt an ache in her heart. The day before, Raymond had phoned. He had talked coolly about how many more years he would live, how much money Katie would get if she stayed in the marriage, how often he expected her to have sex with him, and calculated out that each time she had sex with him, she would make $8,000. More money than most women can earn in their wildest imaginations, Raymond had said. When Nina was told about the conversation, she'd had to remind herself not to get too upset with Raymond, but with Katie also. Katie had simply laughed at Raymond's predictability and at her own predicament. Did you tell your aunt? Nina said. Yes, I thought someone had to tell her. Someone had to help Jock, but I was wrong. My aunt went to Mrs. Gill. She went to the principal, but what good did that do for Jock or for herself? Well, what happened after? Nothing. The same old treatment for Jock. The only thing he could do was wait until fifth grade was over. My mother said she wished I hadn't told Aunt Clara, Katie said. She was right. If a person doesn't have the power to solve a problem, she's only causing pain by sounding an alarm. Nina shook her head. Surely I should have warned you not to marry Raymond. Surely there was a reason you didn't, Katie said. You knew I would insist on making the mistake. You knew it was a mistake? Not the same kind of mistake as telling Aunt Clara about Mrs. Gill. I regretted that. The pain I caused her and Jock, Katie said. And yet, what was it compared to his death? You don't regret marrying Raymond? If you'd grown up in Pigeon Blanc, Indiana, you'd think a bully with money was 10 times better than a bully without money, Katie said. I don't mind dramas. I'm not afraid of jerks. So Katie had entered her marriage, Nina thought, with the same blind courage that had propelled her into parenthood. I couldn't marry one of those good men you thought I should have. You know that. I don't know, Nina said. Why couldn't you? They would have had expectations I wouldn't have been able to meet, Katie said. The point is, you can't marry a good man casually. It causes pain. And yet, a casual marriage to a bully, had it not made Katie suffer in ways she would never admit? Nina thought about that game of charades all those years ago. They had been lucky then, not knowing that once the dots were connected, their lives would look nothing like what they had fantasized about. That, too, should give her some hope. For better or for worse, there are always things that remain unknown to the young, even to the most precocious children, like Ella. Hey, are you all right? Katie said. Not quite, Nina said, but I'll be all right. She was crying, as uncharacteristic of her now as her weeping over a baby's knees had been. It was the past brought into focus, or the future that was always there, taunting them, eluding them. She remembered Ella's winter concert in kindergarten. During the days leading up to it, Ella had practiced taking a bow as meticulously as a scientist conducts an experiment. The music teacher had taught the children to bend at the waist, look at their toes, and say in their quietest voice, "Hello, shoes. Goodbye, shoes," before straightening up. "I always thought she was a genius teacher," Nina said after telling Katie the story. "Hello, sadness. Goodbye, sadness," Katie said, handing Nina the box of Kleenex. "Yes, yes," Nina said, wiping her eyes. "Wouldn't it be nice if everything could be that simple? Hello, pandemic. Goodbye, pandemic." Katie stood up and took a deep bow. "Hello, bad choice. Goodbye, bad choice," she said, with the confidence of a good actor, knowing that the next moment the curtain would fall and she would be free to think about her real life elsewhere. Next, from the Department of Science, November 8, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, energy and how to get it. All of us know people who have more energy than we do, but the science of the phenomena is just coming into view. By Nick Palmgarten. For months, during the main pandemic stretch, I'd get inexplicably tired in the afternoon, as though vital organs and muscles had turned to styrofoam. Just sitting in front of a computer screen in sweatpants and socks left me drained. It seemed ridiculous to be grumbling about fatigue when so many people were suffering through so much more, but we feel how we feel. Nuke a cup of cold coffee, take a walk around the block, the standard tactics usually did the trick. But one advantage or disadvantage of working from home is the proximity of a bed. Now and then you surrender. These mid-afternoon doldrums weren't entirely unfamiliar. Even back in the office years, with editors on the prowl, I learned to sneak the occasional catnap under my desk, alert as a zebra to the telltale footfall of a consequential approach. At home, though, you could power all the way down. Still, the ebb lately had become an acute and hard to account for. By the standards of my younger years, I was burning the candle at neither end. Could one attribute it to the wine the night before? The cookies, the fitful and abbreviated sleep, the boomerang effect of the morning's caffeines and carbs, a sedentary profession, middle age? That will be a yes, and yet the mind roamed. COVID? Lyme? Diabetes? Cancer? It's no HIPAA violation to reveal that, as various checkups determined, none of these pertained. So, embrace it. A recent headline in The Guardian, "Extravagant Eye Bags, How Extreme Exhaustion Became This Year's Hottest Look." It was just a question of energy. The endurance athlete running perilously low on fuel is said to hit the wall or bonk. Cyclists call this feeling the man with the hammer. Applying the parlance to the Sitzweiss life, I told myself that I was bonking. At hour 5 in the desk chair, the document on screen looked like a winding road toward a mountain pass. The man in the sweatpants had met the man with the mattress. All of us, except for the superheroes and the ultra sloths, know people who have more energy than we do, and plenty who have less. We may admire or envy or even pity the tireless project jugglers, the ravenous multidisciplinarians, the serial circulators of rooms, the conference hoppers, the calendar maximizers, the pre-drawn cross-trainers and kickboxers. How does she do it? On the flip side, there are the oversleepers, the homebodies, the spurners of invitations and opportunities, the dispensers of excuses. Come on, man! It's hard to measure success if you want to avoid making it about money or power or credentials. But as one stumbles through the landscape of careers and outputs and reputations, one sees again and again that the standouts tend to be the people who possess seemingly boundless reserves of mental and physical fuel. Entrepreneurs, athletes, artists, politicians, it can seem that energy, more than talent or luck, results in extraordinary outcomes. Why do some people have it and others not? What does one have to do to get more? Energy is both biochemical and psychophysical, vaguely delineated, widely misunderstood, elusive as grace. You know it when you got it. And even more, you know when you don't. This is the enthusiasm and vigor you feel inside yourself, the kind you might call qi after the ancient Chinese life force or the pronouncements of the storefront acupuncturist. The kind you seek to instill by drinking Red Bull or Monster, plunging into an ice bath, or taking psychostimulants like Ritalin or Adderall or Provigil. Biohackers microdose psychedelics, stick ozone tubes up their butts, or pay $1,500 for a 750-milligram dose of NAD4. Energy is why we've made a virtual religion of 1,3,7-trimethylxanthine, otherwise known as caffeine. Society has progressively increased its demands on us, and with that, therefore, our expectations of what we can or should do. Maurizio Fava, the chief of the Department of Psychiatry at Mass General, told me, "This has led to a quest for greater energy. How can I do more? Doctor, what can you give me?" Energy, though, is a misnomer, or at least an illusion. What we commonly call energy is actually our perception of the body metabolizing carbohydrates or fat as energy. Energy isn't energy. It's our experience of burning energy, converting it to work. It's a metabolic mood. As Richard Maurer, a doctor in Maine who specializes in metabolic recovery and who encountered me one day last summer as I mumbled about a shortage of it, told me, energy is a useless term. It is not the perception of stimulation. It is just the capacity to generate work. I think of it as only relating to potential. If a patient says, "I want more energy," maybe the doctor should just write a script for methamphetamine. But that's false qi. The precise workings of the metabolic system, its nuances and contingencies, are, in many respects, an enduring mystery. You'd think we'd have figured out by now how our cells go about their business, this being the most fundamental element of our existence. But they may as well be in deep space or the Mariana Trench. 1.5 billion years ago, the planet's only life forms were single-celled. Fermentation ruled the Earth. Then, an anaerobic bacterium engulfed anaerobic bacterium. In time, the ingested bacterium's capacity for feeding on oxygen managed to increase, by an order of magnitude, the amount of energy available to its anaerobic host. This accidental collaboration made possible the proliferation of multicellular life forms and, eventually, tool-wielding hominids who would come to complain that they feel tired all the time. According to what is known as the endosymbiotic theory of biological complexity, this chocolate meets peanut butter moment, this big mush, is the reason we exist. That aerobic bacterium evolved into what we called mitochondria, the organelles that fuel living creatures, the powerhouses of the cell, as every school kid learns. It's about all I retain from high school bio, anyway, save for Mr. Burns relishing his coinage of the phrase, a smidgen of lipids. Each of us has hundreds, if not thousands, of trillions of mitochondria. They convert glucose and oxygen into adenosine triphosphate, or ATP, the primary cellular fuel. They also help produce the essential hormones, among them estrogen, testosterone, and cortisol, and regulate cellular proliferation and death. It's not inconceivable that the rest of the body, brain, hands, heart, lungs, digestive tract, is merely an elaborate and sometimes clumsy apparatus for the nourishment of the mitochondria. That it is the mitochondria and not Homo sapiens who rule and foul the earth. Our cardiovascular system, that fantastic and vulnerable machine, is essentially a delivery system for the oxygen they require. The mitochondrion is the creature, and we are merely its husk, its fleshy chrysalis. A newborn's first breath? That's the mitochondria calling the shots. That, anyway, is the mitocentric perspective, Martin Picard said on a recent afternoon in his office in Washington Heights. Picard, a partisan of that perspective, is a professor of behavioral medicine at Columbia University Irving Medical Center, where he directs a lab of about a dozen researchers. His work straddles the departments of psychiatry and neurology. His specialty is mitochondrial psychobiology. We try to understand the connection between the mind and the mitochondria, he said. We think about energy a lot. In a mostly sincere attempt to convey how little we know about the workings of consciousness, he said, we have yet to disprove that our brains aren't merely antennas, that all of our thoughts and memories don't just come from out there, he pointed out the window, and that we're not just streaming everything. The main distinguishing characteristic between a cadaver and a living, thinking, feeling individual is the flow of energy through the body, he said. The cells are the same, but without the energy flow, it's just an inert blob. Mitochondria transform chemical energy into electrical energy, Picard explained. Communication and energy go together, he said. The organs and cells can't communicate without energy. Cells talk to each other. The mitochondria, which used to be bacteria, talk to the gut microbiome. They are like cousins. Cells choose to do one thing or another based on the energy available. Energy for cells is like emotions for a human. It causes them to make decisions that may not seem rational. The human body is a social network, Picard said. He compared it to an ant colony, in which every ant has the same genome, but serves a different purpose, much in the way the organs do for a human being. My working hypothesis is that mitochondria do a lot of the sensing and perceiving and integrating of signals, that they are the cellular antenna, or little brains that receive, process, and integrate information. A student in Picard's lab was filling plates with skin cells. Each plate had 96 wells the size of apple seeds, and each of these contained 20,000 cells. She was exposing healthy cells and compromised ones to stress in the form of a synthetic version of cortisol. A whole human lifespan, but in a dish, Picard said. Cells age faster if you expose them to stress. They burn energy faster. It's as though cellular anxiety causes cells to breathe faster. They consume more oxygen. They're wasting energy, and we don't know why. People with mitochondrial disorders struggle to transform energy into ATP. What they experience subjectively is constant tiredness and fatigue, Picard said. They don't have the mojo. Fatigue is the number one symptom. They feel tired all the time. And it's a long diagnostic odyssey. So yes, it seems people can sense when their intracellular energy state is low. Another bit of circumstantial evidence, amytal or amobarbital, an active ingredient in truth serums developed in the U.S. in the 30s, essentially inhibits mitochondrial respiration, supposedly rendering subjects too worn out to lie. Amytal is also what Picard's lab has used in some of its assays. If you mess with the mitochondria, people feel awful, Picard said. It can work the other way, too. A few years ago, Picard's lab did a study in which 91 women reported their mood levels and submitted to mitochondrial tests for 7 days. The study suggested that the mood has a direct effect on mitochondrial health. Gin up! We like to think we have conscious control over our behavior. But the more we learn, the more we know that that's not entirely true. Kevin Hall, who runs a clinical nutrition lab at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, told me, we're less in control than we'd like. Hall has been trying to understand how different sources of energy in our diet affect metabolism. What happens, for example, when we restrict carbs or fat? The body makes huge shifts to accommodate calories in different forms. You're on a low-carb diet. The fat in your blood, triglycerides, stimulates the uptake and blocks the release of fat. Low fat, high starch? Insulin plays that role. The human body is like a vehicle that burns different fuels. It's an incredible engineering challenge. The metabolism is a miraculous flex fuel engine. Diesel, ethanol, doesn't matter in the short term. It will adapt. A recent study published in the journal Current Biology determined that the body seems to adjust to higher burn rate by becoming more efficient, especially with exercise. This is called energy compensation and is not yet well understood. Generally, when your body burns through energy less efficiently, you are likely to die earlier and have a greater risk of disease. An inefficient metabolic system is like a car engine. You rev too high, it rears out faster. Richard Maurer comes from a family of long-distance runners. In college, he was obsessed with calories, what was and wasn't working when he ran. The simple equation of calories in and out, the default presumption, didn't actually seem to measure up. At the time, in the 80s, it was hard to find medical schools that taught nutrition, except the one in Loma Linda, and that was run by Seventh-day Adventists, he said. So he wound up at the National College for Naturopathic Medicine in Portland, Oregon. What was then fringe is now tacking sharply to the mainstream. Every day we learn one thing less, Maurer said. He cited a study of elite cyclists. They rode hard on a stationary bike and, when their muscles were spent, were given water on one occasion and a sweet drink like Gatorade on another, both of which they spit out without swallowing. The water spitters lagged behind in terms of subsequent wattage produced. The taste of sugar had apparently tricked the brain into releasing energy that it had been hoarding for other functions. In some ways, the bonk is a perception, Maurer said. In September, Sai Krupa Das, a scientist at the Jean Mayer USDA Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging and a professor of nutrition at Tufts, sent me a RAND Corporation survey she and other clinicians used to get a sense of psychobiological energy. In one section, you are supposed to rate on a scale of 1 to 6 from all of the time to none of the time your experience of the past 4 weeks. Here are the questions. Did you feel full of pep? Have you been a nervous person? Have you felt so down in the dumps that nothing could cheer you up? Have you felt calm and peaceful? Did you have a lot of energy? Have you felt downhearted and blue? Did you feel worn out? Have you been a happy person? Did you feel tired? All of the above? Is variability of mood more like HRV or like blood sugar? It was hard to imagine a more subjective exercise. Das also sent me a link to the website of something called the Human Performance Institute at Johnson & Johnson, which offered a survey that was a kind of screening for the corporate athlete. Who doesn't love a self-evaluation? I aimed to be honest. The J&J verdict was that I was disengaged. This suggests that significant obstacles stand in the way of fully igniting your talent and skill. To become an extraordinary performer, you must build significantly stronger energy management skills. The corporate Olympics would have to go on without me. Das didn't have a test for the other kind of energy, the kind that one projects. This kind of energy does exist, and people who have it generally do have that aura about them, she said. But it is certainly hard to measure. This energy is in large part physiological, too. There's a genetic component and a biological underpinning for cellular health that reflects in tissue health. Each day I fixated on the data from my wearables, even as my resistance to change rendered them moot. I was more interested in adding exercise than in giving up my morning toast or evening whiskey. I sought the Whoop's approval, if not that of its other evangelist. I'll invite you to join our group and help coach you, Arno wrote. What's your Whoop name? Not telling. The Whoop's version of what the Aura called readiness was recovery, also HRV-based. For exercise, it emphasized strain, a more robust version of the OURA's activity category. It rewarded a high heartbeat and a hard workout and basically turned up its nose at long walks. It preferred sweat to steps. And yet, the other day, an old friend passed through town from the Bay Area. We'd grown up across the street from each other and, in our fifth grade production of Alice in Wonderland, had played Twiddledum and Twiddledee. We met up in Central Park and walked and talked for an hour, no secrets at this age, and then said our fond farewells. I returned to the desk chair, energized. That evening, I checked the data. The Aura ring, generous to a fault, gave me credit for burning 224 calories. Ball don't lie. The Whoop, though, had captured something else entirely. The readout from our meander suggested that I'd undergone my most grueling physical trial, not only since I got the device, but in many years, possibly decades. It had me at nearly 50 minutes with an average heart rate above 150, plus 12 minutes above 167, with a high of 185. Basically, according to the Whoop, I'd won the Tour de France and was now dead. Or the Whoop, for once, was mistaken. A glitch not in the Matrix, but in the watch. Then, there was a third possibility. My friend and I had had an excellent rapport on our stroll, a surge of groovy vibes and hearty laughter. Could this energy, the kind that is projected, perceived, and exchanged, yet purportedly impossible to measure, have somehow spun the monitor's compass, like a poltergeist or a solar flare? Was my Whoop a spiritist? A line of Tweedledees came to mind. Contrarywise, if it was so, it might be. And if it were so, it would be. But as it isn't, it ain't. That's logic. And finally, a poem from the November 15, 2021 issue. The End of the World by Clarence Major. I look out the window at a silent, dark night, a night of blue and rust with specks of yellow. Neighborly windows mostly dark, entryway across the street bright. The front door locked, always locked at 11. Below my window, under streetlights brightly lighted from inside, a three-car commuter train quietly slides by as if on water. I turn back to the TV. I'm watching a movie about the end of the world, always about to happen. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.